Hi, this is Kurt, and you are listening to the final installment of a special podcast series from Studio 360. During this month leading up to the Academy Awards, we've been bringing you conversations with all five of this year's Oscar-nominated Best Directors. This week, Tom McCarthy, who directed Spotlight. What I get to do here at Studio 360 is about as easy and fun as a job in journalism gets. Hard journalism is hard in the other sense, too. Not glamorous at all. It's making lots and lots of phone calls to strangers and to people who don't want to talk to you or tell you the truth. It's reading endless, boring documents. It's working on stories that don't pan out, or when they do, usually nobody much notices. Which makes the movie Spotlight all the more remarkable. It's about how the Boston Globe investigative team uncovered staggeringly pervasive sexual abuse of children by Roman Catholic priests in Boston.
We've got two stories here. A story about degenerate clergy, and a story about a bunch of lawyers turning child abuse into a cottage industry.
The church's long-term cover-up of all that.
Mitch, are you telling me that the Catholic Church removed legal documents from that courthouse?
And the eventual realization that this was a long-running horror show happening all over the world.
We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
In that last clip was Liev Schreiber as the Globe's editor Marty Baron. Tom McCarthy co-wrote the screenplay and directed the film, which is up for 6 Oscars, including Best Original Screenplay and Best Director. And maybe you'd already associated Tom McCarthy with newspapers. He's never worked as a journalist, but he did famously play a fictional one, the despicable Baltimore reporter Scott Templeton from season 5 of The Wire, who fabricates stories to try and get on the front page.
Our job is to report the news, not to manufacture it.
It's in my notes, Gus. Everything that happened, everything that guy said when I got to him. Every last word is in my notes!
Like season 5 of The Wire, Spotlight depicts all those aspects of hard journalism. The phone calls, the interviews, the pages and pages and pages of documents. In a way that is stark and authentic, yet somehow very entertaining.
That was one of the gambles of this movie. We committed to process. We said, let's show all the little bits that add up to something truly extraordinary in terms of the result of this investigation. And we completely committed to the craft of journalism in some ways, warts and all, and boring and tedium and all. I think early on, Josh and I, spending so much time with the reporters, felt in fact that we were conducting our own investigation into their investigation.
Yeah.
And we committed to that. And it certainly informed our writing every step of the way. And, you know, we were probably even guilty of geeking out a little bit on all the little details of the work that they do.
Yeah.
And I think when you see the film and you kind of get hooked on that, which audience seems to be doing, you appreciate that much more their work and their efforts.
Yeah. This is your fifth feature film. The first one that is based on very real specific events. Did that change the nature of the writing, directing, making job for you?
Not specifically. Ultimately, the job's the job. It was a really fascinating amount of research. I mean, look, we had no source material. There was nothing written about the investigation, which is the primary
focus.
There
wasn't a book about it.
No, they didn't.
Which is weird, actually.
You'd think so, but I think those reporters are busy.
Yeah.
And look, they spent 2 years reporting on this story, and quite honestly, I think they were burned out. It's incredibly sensitive and at times very dark material. So what we had to do was spend hundreds of hours interviewing reporters, publishers, lawyers, PR people, educators, and I can never leave out and say enough about the survivors we talked to who were generous enough to share their stories.
And you talked to them, these people who had been victimized.
Yeah, specifically two of them that we sat with were Phil Saviano and Joe Crowley, both depicted in the film, and just extraordinary gentlemen who have really turned their lives around and become activists in the fact that this never happens again. Like they're really, you only have to really sit with one survivor to understand the impact of this crime and how this is something that these men and women, in some cases, carry with them for the rest of their lives.
Was that, oh, this director's coming in, you sit down with him for an hour, good, nice talking to you. What was that? What were those experiences
no,
like?
No. I mean, I still email with both these gentlemen. So once you develop a relationship, much like the reporters, it continues. And their back and forth was incredibly informative in putting the screenplay together
really?
And putting the language together.
So before you wrote the screenplay, it wasn't just, oh, I want to meet this guy to see what he's like.
No,
now
no.
That we've
it was
him.
Sit down. It was interview, record it. Josh and I recorded every interview we sat. We did. We would sit back with those tapes and kind of review them for language. And then we would let them read scenes. We let Phil Saviano read some of the
really?
Scenes and actually give us input on some of the language. I mean, this is a man that's been, you know, studying this now, and not just having survived it, but has been living and studying it for 25, 30 years. So his input was invaluable.
And who, as a character in the film, I mean, he's a survivor. And he's been through this terrible thing, but
yeah.
But he's not. He's a quirky, complicated,
yeah.
not easy to love character in the film.
I think you're right, and I think that points a little bit to the difficult job of reporters trying to suss out when someone is a solid source or when
yeah.
someone's a sketchy source.
Yeah. So, other than being Catholic and a filmmaker, what got you interested in this story?
Really, the first thing that sort of grabbed my attention was the sort of thumbnail intro to the film, which is Marty Baron arriving at the Boston Globe, the first outside editor to take over the reins of the paper.
And Jewish to boot.
And Jewish to boot. Arriving in arguably one of the most Catholic and Irish of American cities. And day one, asking some very simple but profound questions about the Catholic Church's alleged complicity in this priest abuse scandal that had been occurring throughout the country.
And it really was that. He was absolutely new and suddenly said, hey, what about this thing?
Yeah, I mean, as told to us by Marty himself, he didn't know much about the Boston Globe. He accepted the job. He started reading the Globe. They started shipping him copies. This was pre-internet, at least at that level. And he started reading about 3 weeks earlier. He arrived on a Friday and over the weekend read a column by Eileen McNamara, a really wonderful journalist at the Globe, which was writing about a lawyer, Mitchell Garabedian, who said he had proof that Cardinal Law knew about these abuses and did nothing. And at the end of this column, Eileen McNamara wrote something to the effect of, we may never know the truth. And to Marty, that was a red flag, and he started asking questions.
And the period thing is interesting to me because it's only, I mean, to me, only because, it's, you know, it seems only 14 or 15 years ago. Yet in its depiction of a newsroom seems like
right.
a period piece. I mean, yeah, they had computers, but it wasn't really a computer-driven investigation. The newspaper business hadn't imploded and essentially been destroyed yet.
Yeah. Yep.
It must have felt like you're making this period movie that happened the day before yesterday.
Look, whenever you're making a movie like this, even though it has appeared, you're trying to make it as relevant and urgent and in some ways contemporary as you can. You want the audience to be hooked. You want
yeah.
them to be involved. But yes, I've heard from reporters all over the country now, and the word they keep using is nostalgic.
Well, exactly.
It made me nostalgic for the period where the press was at the height of their powers, when they were fully funded, fully supported, and we had professional journalists, as depicted in this film, doing their work and doing it at extremely high
And the
level.
Internet was this little thing that we might...
Off in the distance.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
a fad at
yeah,
that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And two of the main characters, Marty Baron and Robbie Robinson, who is played by Michael Keaton and heads the investigations team, are of the essentially Woodward and Bernstein generation, people
yeah.
who – and I guess Marty Baron's a little younger, but people who came of age and became journalists
yeah.
at that moment when
yeah.
investigations, that was it. And this is kind of – you're depicting the last hurrah of that era.
I'm a little bit more of an optimist than that.
Good for you.
Thank you. In the regard that, yes, we're not going back to that period. You're right. When the sort of market crashed in the journalism industry in 2005, 2006, that was it. It's done. So we're not going back to
no.
that. So enjoy the movie. That said, this film may inspire, hopefully, not just new journalists, a new wave of journalists,
no.
but innovators, someone to figure out what's the new model. Because what this does... What this should be a rallying cry is for strong investigative journalism, not just on a national level, but on all the small towns and cities.
Especially
and
on that level, which is where it has died.
Exactly. There's nothing there. Who's minding the store? Someone said to me recently, you know, about a year ago recently, when I was doing some of the research, like, it's a great time to be in small-time corruption. Like, this is it. That's the market right now. And it's true. This was a local story. They had no idea the impact this story
had. And it was a local story uncovered by this essentially monopoly-quality newspaper in New England, who had all the money in the world to do it.
Exactly. And what's really interesting, and we're finding now, having the movie been out for 11, 12 weeks and, you know, now expanding internationally, is this story is still playing out. I mean, we are hearing from survivors, from organizations on a regular basis. Like, people now, because cinema has such a big platform, people are feeling the confidence and courage to come forward again. And so, you know, the story is very much still being told, not just here, but around the world. And it's really fascinating when you make a movie. You know, look, my first job is to make an entertaining film. Mm-hmm. But when it's really, when you can really feel it moving the needle ever so slightly, it's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. You grew up in an Irish Catholic family. Not in Boston, but you went to the Jesuits' wonderful Boston College.
Correct.
As a Catholic, are you like the reporters in the movie and my wife and almost every Catholic I know, raised Catholic, but mostly or kind of lapsed?
Yeah, I guess if meh is the official term, that suits me. I have, you know, I would consider myself a lapsed Catholic. My family is still quite connected to the church, my brothers, sisters, my mother. And I have a lot of friends in that community, and I think very highly of that community and the impact they have. It certainly gave me a sort of a foothold into the material. I understood the culture, I understood the power and presence of the church, specifically in the Irish Catholic community specifically in Boston, having attended Boston College. You know, I think as a filmmaker, as a writer, first and foremost, and I should say I co-wrote this with Josh Singer, my wonderful co-writer, you know, I felt like that gave me some way to approach this. And you're right, the reporters were all lapsed Catholics and they lived in that community and they cared a lot about it. And I think it was certainly added pressure to their already high pressure position.
Yeah. I can imagine that studios would say, this is more like what TV does. It's not really feature film material. How hard was it to get them to say yes and get financing? And were there key moments that made it happen as a deal?
To answer your question, it's very difficult. Look, ultimately, yes, it's a journalism story, but it's also a story about the courage of survivors of sexual abuse, specifically at the hands of the Catholic Church. That's a difficult topic to sell. It doesn't scream box office. But we had some great
parts. Who's the superhero?
Exactly. Marty Baron and the rest of the Globe reporters. But, you know, we did have some really wonderful partners, some wonderful producers, Anonymous Content, Participant Media, who I've made two films with now. People who make movies that they think can really have a social impact.
Yeah.
And even all that said and done, we eventually connected with Open Road, our distributor. We had all these wonderful players, but it was still really difficult to make it work. That's just the environment we live in right now in terms of our film culture. And it really, there was three times we thought this project was dead and it kept coming. We just, persistence paid off ultimately and we got to the starting line.
But it was, Liev is going to be on, so he's big enough. I couldn't see what would have been the thing that finally made everybody say, okay, fine, we'll do it.
It's a great question because we can, as you know, it's an incredible cast. Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, Stanley Tucci, Liev Schreiber. It just keeps going on. Rachel McAdams.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very deep bench, as I like to say. And I kept adding actors who I thought were the right for the role. And they were like, could you get one more? This is crazy.
Yeah.
So what happened as a result is we have a wonderful cast. It's a great question. I think it was really just persistence and working with numbers, shrinking our budget, shrinking our shooting days, and just finding a way to make it work. And that's a very collaborative effort.
I want to play a clip, which is a heated discussion between the Boston Globe reporter, Mike Resendiz, played by Mark Ruffalo, and Michael Keaton's character, his boss, Robbie Robinson. They're discussing how to handle the documents that apparently demonstrate the church and cardinal law had covered up these years of sex abuse.
If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher this story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We gotta nail these scumbags. We gotta show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
That was Mark Ruffalo and Michael Keaton in Spotlight. Now, that's a key moment, and it's a drama, and you gotta have a moment like that. And maybe it happened, but journalists seldom give that aria. Or if they do, they don't last long in their newsrooms. Did you worry like, oh, this is just too much, this is too dramatic in the melodramatic sense?
Well, I always worry about just about everything. as a director, it's part of my job description. I will say this. That is probably the one blow up in the movie. It happens about three quarters of the way in the movie, and it happens when the tension has built quite a bit. So it felt at that point like it was time for release. And it's not unlike Mike Resendez to get very fiery and overstep, and he'll be the first to tell you that. And this also comes at a moment where they discovered these 14 documents that were virtually plucked from the Archdiocese file cabinets, which told them everything they needed to know.
Right.
When you read these letters from parishioners to the cardinal, it is absolutely beyond belief. It is heartbreaking. It is tragic. And this felt like the moment to express that, knowing that these guys, specifically Mike and Robbie, banged heads quite a bit. It's just part of the job. It's part of a very, I think, successful collaboration, to be quite honest. So in this moment, that's what we were focusing on as filmmakers. I will say, I think what's really important about this scene is what Robbie's saying. Yes, we could go with this. We could, but we're going to be patient. We're going to get the whole story. And I think that's what made this story so absolutely effective, ultimately, was that they had the patience not to rush this to press. And there's many instances along the way they could have. I think a lesser paper, lesser editors.
The Boston Herald, for instance.
The Herald absolutely would have. but I think, you know, that's an important element. And, you know, specifically now in this 24-hour news cycle, I mean, things are on, you know, something's reported all the time and then retracted all the time. What happens? It loses effectiveness.
Yeah.
And they were so patient, and this story was so effective as a result.
Right. Well, and the thing the movie doesn't say, but is true in my experience over many years being in and out of journalism, is investigative journalists are a different species. Mm. They are indeed over-invested sometimes, and sure they're right, and screw you, editor, and the Ruffalo character is like those guys, which is to say, they sometimes have a bit of a screw loose. Not that real person did, but do you know what I mean?
I absolutely know what you mean. It's funny. As a filmmaker, I collaborate with a host of different artists, right? And I will say, one day it occurred to me that journalists in some way remind me of musicians. They just beat to their own. They just beat to their own drum. They do their own thing and they do it their way. And you know, I'm not terribly musical, so I have to figure out a way to communicate with musicians, especially when I'm scoring a film, obviously. And I found the same way with journalists, especially investigative journalists.
Yes.
They're their own breed, and it's weird. They're incredibly dynamic people. They're very serious people, and they're also, you know, because they were the sort of subject of our investigation, they're sometimes very difficult to penetrate, to get to know. They do not like being in that seat. They like asking the questions. So,
and keeping their cards close to their vest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is a hard thing to generalize about, but what has the reaction of non-lapsed Catholics, members of your family and otherwise, been as they've seen this movie?
Surprisingly and wonderfully positive, both from the institution, including Cardinal O'Malley, who replaced Cardinal Law in Boston, had some very nice things to say about the film. And throughout the country, we've heard that. And then, of course, from the laity. And then on a personal level, you're right. I've been hearing from my mother's friends and, you know, devout Catholics for their entire lives, wonderful emails. And there's so many communities that have reached out to us. And look, I think we never saw this as a divisive film in that way. Everything that we present in the film, by and large, is on the record. So it was really just making people aware of the story and making people aware that this is still going on, as we do at the end of the film. And providing a platform for people to continue this discussion to ensure that this never happens again.
Well, and you're not challenging the theology, so...
No, I think
you're just saying there are some bad guys who did a lot of bad things in high places.
It has nothing to do with theology. It has a lot to do with the institution.
Yeah.
And as we all know, there's a lot of institutions that go wrong. And look, I think it speaks to the sort of macro theme of the movie, which is what's really connecting with audiences, which is accountability and personal responsibility and societal deference and complicity. What's our part in this? And I think we could ask that about just anything happening today, and we should be.
As it was happening, and then seeing your movie made me think this again, it's astonishing to me still. I imagine if a global corporation had committed the comparable crime cover-up
yes.
scandal, it would be over, I think.
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
And in a certain way, we talk about accountability, but like Catholic Church, going fine still.
You know, I was just in Ireland promoting the film, and Ireland is angry. They are angry with the Catholic Church beyond anything I've seen represented in this country, maybe because of their connection to the church.
Well, and everybody's Catholic.
Absolutely. Not so much anymore.
I know.
In fact, many of them refer to it as a post-Catholic Ireland.
Yeah.
And I think it's representative of just that. Their question is, why is the church still in existence?
Now, yes.
Now you're getting into people's faith.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's touchy ground. But you're right. If it was if it was a university, that university would be shut down. This is systemic abuse.
Yeah.
So it does. It raises yet another very compelling question.
Yeah. The investigation was long and complicated, and you suggest that. But obviously, there were many moving parts and personalities and storylines that you could have also put in. Were there a bunch that you said, I'd love to do that. We can't fit it in 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Of course. It was a 6-month investigation. There were characters. There were elements of the story which thought, wow. And some of those we had to conflate. So if we couldn't get it exactly right, it was about getting the spirit of the investigation. And, you know, keep in mind, some of these moments were, there were similar moments in what they represented. So we're always trying to cherry pick. But that was one of the difficult processes in terms of the writing, was condensing that and finding, you know, what really conveyed. And for instance, you know, in the midst of this amazing, massive investigation, a 9/11 occurs.
Right. Now, which you have in the film.
Which we have to. I mean, we couldn't possibly omit it. Obviously, it's a film about factual accuracy. But it presented a wonderful challenge and a really interesting obstacle. And, you know, we just kind of leaned into that because it was, in fact, a challenge to the reporters.
Yeah, because it made nobody want to be interested in pursuing this thing when we have the largest story of the last
exactly. It was really interesting because here they are very, you know, they got this story very quickly, especially by their standards, because there was so much information available. And then 9/11 happens. And to the one of them, I said, wow, did you not want to get off the story? And say, no, it was 9/11. Two of those planes came out of Boston. There was no question. We all dropped everything.
Yeah.
But they said, after 5 or 6 weeks of reporting, we really wanted to get back. So we knew we were on a very important story.
Were there bits of the spotlight investigation of the sex abuse in the church that you wish that were heartbreaking not to be able to put in the film?
No. I don't think we left anything out that we thought was too impactful, too dramatic. I think if it was relevant and important, it's in the film.
And it's a complicated movie, but it's not a terribly long movie. When you finish your first cut, how long was it?
Honestly, not that long. I think we did a really good job on the screenplay. We had a lot of time on it, and I think the film reflects that. I think my rough cut was 220, 225, and the final cut of the film's 208, including credits. So we left a lot in there. It was really just
shaping.
That's
impressive.
Yeah, it's impressive, and it may be a bit misleading because I can't credit my longtime editor, Tom McArdle, for the work he did. It's incredibly, you know, you've brought it up at the top of the interview, right? It's a lot of what could be very boring, tedious moments. How to make that not only compelling, but how to keep it fluid, to keep it moving. And I really got to give him a lot of credit for that work.
It has pretty heroic heroes. We heard the Mark Ruffalo speech earlier. It has all this old-fashioned shoe leather reporting. It has no sex, I don't think. It has no car chases. It has no violence. It has no CGI. And justice triumphs. And cinematically, it's very linear and straightforward. Did you envision it as a kind of plain old-fashioned movie?
Yeah. Look, I think whenever I take on a film, the style in which I direct it, write and direct it, is representative of the film itself, of the content.
Yeah,
and here we're
yeah.
talking about journalism. It ain't flashy. It ain't sexy.
Right.
It gets to the point, and when it's done well, it's incredibly impactful, and that's what we were shooting for. Yeah. And I think to suddenly impose a style that felt too manipulated or too...
I'm watching a movie.
Yeah, you'd be aware you watch a movie. We wanted people to feel like they were observing this, yeah. like they were living it. It's 2001. You're there. What do you do?
Right.
And so we favored that style, and it's a very austere approach to the material, and hopefully people don't even realize it. hopefully they're just caught up in it.
And I wondered, in addition to it being an excellent movie, is its old-fashionedness one of the reasons that the 66-year-old Academy voters love it so much?
That's fine with me, you know. a lot of them are smart movie watchers. Obviously the movie, we can tell by the box office of what it's doing critically, it's appealing to a lot of people.
For
it's reaching a lot of folks. And I'd like to think in this marketplace of, where there's a lot of spectacle in film
yes.
right now, and certainly a fair amount of genre, that there's still room for a serious, well-told story.
No, and it's heartening that you're proving that. of course, it reminds one of All the President's Men. To what degree was that an inspiration, a starting off point? I don't want to do that thing they did there.
It's a seminal movie, right? So I love the movie. Not forget about being a director, just as a moviegoer, it's just a great movie. It's incredibly well
written. Did you see it at 15 when it came out?
No, I probably saw it a little bit later. I think I saw it a little bit later.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I wasn't a serious moviegoer early on. Like, it didn't really hit me to later.
Actually, you're probably only 10. You're
yeah.
young.
Yeah, I probably was too young. I revisited it when I was 15, when I was mature. But with a film like that, you recognize it, you honor it, and then you forget it because you got
yeah.
work to do, and you try not to let it. Otherwise, when I'm getting ready to make a film, I stop reading. I stop seeing movies.
Yep.
I just want to find what's original about this material.
Yeah. You played a journalist on The Wire who made up stories,
right.
this loathsome yuppie. And you don't seem to be a loathsome yuppie. What was your understanding of that character as you played him for a season? You must have found ways to be sympathetic.
I have to credit David Simon with that and his team because I was actually editing The Visitor when they cast me in that, and I didn't have a lot of time.
The great Richard Jenkins film, yes.
Yes, nominated for an Oscar. Wonderful actor. Actually, it appears in Spotlight. He plays the voice of Richard Sipe. I called on him, and he plays the ex-priest who keeps calling in and giving Mike
uh-huh.
information on the phone. That's the great Richard Jenkins.
Huh.
But I was editing The Visitor, and I was kind of – David called me and said, I have this role for you if you're interested. And I said, yeah, sure. And he didn't tell me much about it. He just said, I just think it's right for you. Later on, I discovered it's the most weaselly character
yes.
in the history of the show.
Yes.
And maybe the most reviled.
Just as Mr. Quisling became a word, that guy could become the word for bad –
yeah.
Weasley journalist.
Yeah, I was it. I mean, yeah. For years after, I would go to do press for any of my movies or walk through a newspaper, and people would just be glaring at me. People really
yeah.
don't like me. But what a great show. And, that just unfolded. And what David kept telling me along the way was, you're not a bad guy. You're just ambitious. You
right.
just want to get to the top. You
right.
want to make an impact.
Right.
And it's a wonderful way to play it. It's a very smart direction.
And as a guy who had shown the world how horrible an ambitious journalist can be, was that one of the reasons like, oh, showing journalists as actual heroes, that I want to do that now? Was that part of it?
No, I'm not near that nice. I just did it because it's a good story.
Yeah. You were this successful – and are – but you were this successful working actor in television and film for 15 years or so before you wrote and directed your first film. Why, and more interestingly to me, how did you move from career one in, early middle age to career two?
Just that. I was acting. I was having a good career as an actor. You have time in your hands. I'd always been a writer, and I wrote The Station Agent, and that movie changed my life, the
yeah.
reception of that movie. I had no idea at the time. It was really just – I was curious. It was an exercise in what's it feel like to be on the other side, and how can I execute the vision of something I've written. You can never anticipate the impact that movie had on my career. And then shortly after that, I went to when that movie was finished, Pixar invited me, Pete Docter specifically, the wonderful director of this year's Inside Out, to work on a movie called Up.
Yes.
So I went there and started writing with him on the first couple drafts of that. And
so on the basis of having written station agent, he said, "Oh, you're
yeah.
I want you for Up."
Literally, I went there to screen it. They invited me to screen it at Pixar. And afterwards, I was in the cafeteria and Pete approached me, t-shirt and shorts. He looked like he was 14. And we started chatting. I'm like, "What do you do?" And he said, "Well, I directed Monsters, Inc." We had this great conversation. And he called me a couple weeks later. He's like, "I'm stuck on a story. Would you come out here and help me?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely."
You're a lucky man.
That was a lucky break.
Are you done acting?
I hope not. I hope not. I hope my agent's listening to this and she's feeling the heat.
Really? Why?
I love acting.
Sure.
I started doing that. It was my entree into all this. Look, if you told me, you know, when I was 20 that I'd be an actor for a profession, I would have laughed in your face. The fact that now I've not only had this acting career, but I'm able to make movies, I feel like the luckiest guy on the planet. It's a great, great job. There's something about acting that's just fun. And honestly, it provides me the opportunity to collaborate with other directors, other writers,
right.
Not only to watch them work from the sidelines, but to be immersed in that work. And that's incredibly informative.
You made The Station Agent, which, as you say, got everybody loved and got all this attention as it was a very unorthodox film in every respect. Although it's one of its stars has gone into great celebrity as well.
Peter Dinklage.
You. You made The Visitor, Richard Jenkins, great movie. Your last movie before Spotlight was The Cobbler, which critics didn't much like. Yeah. I haven't seen, so I can't speak to that. And I don't think that many people beyond the critics saw it, probably. Was that a terrible, terrible experience?
No, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, no. It's the first time I'm looking you directly in the eye. It's a fascinating experience. Is it hard? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always hard. It's hard to make a good movie. It was incredibly liberating in a way. I'd made three movies that were very critically, very well received.
Yes.
Station Agent,
Visitor, and did okay. I looked up there. They probably all broke even.
By all accounts, very good.
Yes.
All good. And then I made The Cobbler, which is very different than those movies. And you're right. The critics went after it early on in a way that felt felt a little bit like they're all on the bandwagon.
Well, a lot of pent-up anti-Adam Sandler feeling, I
yeah,
think,
man,
in the critical
they really don't like Adam, which is evident and unfortunate because I don't know a nicer, more generous,
yeah.
hardworking actor than
yeah.
Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And I would work with him again in a flash. That said, it's a really interesting thing to go through. I was actually in pre-production for Spotlight when that was all playing out at the Toronto Film Festival, and I thought, well, if this is the worst of it, I just have to keep telling stories and take away what I can, but that's why I wouldn't categorize that as a bad experience, but a really fascinating, informative one.
And how wonderful and movie-like that Spotlight followed, which
yeah.
has now not only got all these Oscar nominations, by my reckoning, has probably made more money already than all of your previous films combined.
Yeah.
So for the last 3 months, are agents and other and actors and the industry just treating you differently, like you're magic and wonderful now? They must be.
Oh, absolutely. No, no.
No, I'm serious.
No.
They must.
No, that's crazy.
They have to be.
Well, if they are, they're not doing it in
really,
front of me.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't sense, Tom, yeah, now
you know
I want to be next to you.
You know, maybe it's my perspective from being in it all. But, you know, I've been doing this for a while. I've had a lot of wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
I've been able to, most importantly, including The Cobbler, make exactly the movies I wanted to make.
Yeah.
And every time I'm ready to make a movie. And for me, that's the game. Make another movie and make it the best you can. So that's how I look at it. Am I thrilled with the response? Six Oscar nominations?
Yeah.
It's a great thing,
yeah.
of course. Do I feel a big change? No, I don't. Maybe because I'm still putting the movie out there and still dealing with it. So we'll see what the future brings. But for me, it's thrilling. It's exciting, not just for me, but for the movie business.
Right.
That movies like this, as you pointed out, are getting attention. And I think it's going to allow me to make another movie.
Yeah. A big story about this year's Academy Awards is the whiteness of the nominees. Does it temper your joy in some way?
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, who heads the Academy, has done a wonderful job of managing this, of feeling both the frustration and the hurt, but committing to action, and she already has. I think this is not just endemic of our community, of the Academy, but of a greater society, and I think we will lead in change. I think you will see that. But at the same point, I know firsthand from hearing from people within our community that it doesn't take away from our achievement. And,
right.
and keep in mind, the specific film, Spotlight, is representing a very disenfranchised community, the survivors of sexual abuse, who for the first time have a really big platform that they're very excited about. And we will continue to push on this film for that very reason. It also speaks to the greater theme of this movie, accountability. Accountability. What's my part in this and what can I do to make a difference? And I think that's something everyone in my community is asking right now.
Even if I didn't do it. I'm not a racist. I didn't cover up this abuse.
We're all a part of it. We all have some say in it. And even if it's asked question is, can I do anything to make it better? If we just ask that question, if we all assume some responsibility, it'll change.
Tom McCarthy, it's been a pleasure. Congratulations. This has been great.
It's been fun chatting. Real pleasure.
Spotlight is up for 6 Oscars, including Best Original Screenplay and Best Director. And that's it for our special Director's Cut series. Thank you very much for listening. If you haven't heard them all, go to our podcast feed to hear uncut conversations with this year's other 4 nominees: Alejandro Iñárritu, Adam McKay, George Miller, and Lenny Abramson. And one last thing. We've turned the Oscars ceremony into a massive multiplayer interactive bingo game.
You like me right now. You like me.
Instead of squares for B9 or N27, our squares say things like puts on glasses for teleprompter and mentions the journey that led to the Oscar. So play Oscars bingo with us on Sunday night, February 28th. Print a bingo card from our website or play right on your phone or pad or computer. We'll be playing along too and sharing in all the gratuitous sarcasm on Twitter. We've got everything you need for Oscars bingo at studio360.org. Thank you for spending these last 40 minutes with me.
I thank you for really making me feel...
I love it up here.